Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Caesar versus Pompey, Determining Rome's Greatest General, Statesman and Nation Builder, by Stephen Dando Collins. Narrated by Michael Page. Limit of liability / disclaimer of warranty. While the publisher and the author have used their best efforts in preparing this book, they make no representations or warranties with respect to the accuracy or completeness of the contents, and specifically disclaim any implied warranties of merchantability or fitness for a particular purpose. No warranty may be created or extended by sales representatives or written sales materials. The advice and strategies contained herein may not be suitable for your situation. You should consult with a professional where appropriate. Neither the publisher nor the author shall be liable for any loss of profit or any other commercial damages, including but not limited to special, incidental, consequential, or other damages. Introduction. This book tells the parallel life stories of Julius Caesar and Pompey the Great, as we see their lives and loves intertwined and interdependent, as they grew from rivals to partners, then from joint rulers to warring foes. One strove to preserve the Roman Republic, the other destroyed it. Few people have had as many words written about them down through the centuries as Julius Caesar. A brilliant general who made the seductive Queen Cleopatra of Egypt his mistress, he has captured the imagination of playwrights, historians, soldiers, and emperors. In comparison, little has been written about his ally, son-in-law, and eventual enemy Pompeius Magnus, or Pompey the Great, who crashed onto the Roman scene as a victorious 23-year-old general, and who, at the height of his career, was arguably more famous, more popular, and more successful than Caesar. But history, they say, is written by the victors. That certainly was true in the case of Caesar, who was victorious over Pompey in battle and went on to become dictator of Rome. His own well-written accounts, and those sanctioned by the emperors who followed him, painted Caesar as a man fighting for the underdog against the autocrats. Caesar's admirers in later times would include France's Emperor Napoleon, the Kaisers of Germany, and Italian dictator Benito Mussolini. By the 20th century, noted American general Norman Schwarzkopf was describing Pompey as the rebel and Caesar as a champion of democracy. But was it so? Who was Rome's greatest general, statesman, and nation-builder? Caesar or Pompey? Which one of them was in the right? Was either of them in the right? Was the 500-year-old Roman Republic worth preserving? Or, considering the Republic's flaws and the flaws of its leaders, was democracy doomed and autocracy inevitable? Is this the future fate of today's great republics? Listen to this exploration of the parallel lives of Caesar and Pompey and decide for yourself. 1. A bolt of lightning changes everything. Outside the Colline Gate in the Servian Wall, on the northern outskirts of Rome, rain beat down on rows of tents as a late summer thunderstorm lashed the city. Thunder clapped fiercely in the dark clouds above. Striding around the camp in full armour, ignoring the rain and disdainful of the booming heavens, was the 48-year-old general commanding the tens of thousands of Roman troops quartered there. The Colline Gate was the most northerly of Rome's gates. North of it rose the Pincian Hill, while west of it spread the full expanse of the Field of Mars, a low plain of some 1.5 square miles, with the River Tiber on its western boundary. The field took its name from the altar of the war god Mars, which stood here, and apart from a brief time when a king of Rome took possession of it, the Field of Mars was public land, lying outside the Pomerium, the traditional boundary of the old city of Rome. Here on the Field of Mars, so tradition held, the dying Romulus, co-founder of Rome, had ascended to heaven in a dark cloud before the eyes of his assembled warriors. Now tens of thousands of Roman troops were encamped on the eastern extremity of the Martian field. For, in this year 87 BC, Rome was rent by civil war between the followers of the ex-consuls Marius and Sulla. For centuries since the overthrow of the last king of Rome in 509 BC, the Republic of Rome had been governed by two elected officials, the consuls, who took their seats as presidents of the Roman Senate each January and served for 12 months, after which a new pair took their place. In January 87 BC, the two new consuls taking the reins were Gnaeus Octavius and Lucius Cornelius Cinna. Both were ambitious men. Both had personally sworn loyalty to Lucius Cornelius Sulla, the dominating consul of 88 BC. In early 87 BC, Sulla had left Rome to take up the Senate appointment of commander of a Roman army that was being sent from Italy to counter the Pontic king Mithridates VI Eupator, later to be labelled Mithridates the Great, who had overrun much Roman territory in the east. Neither Octavius nor Cinna liked each other, and once Sulla left Rome, the pair was frequently in dispute, with Cinna going against his oath of support for Sulla, which he'd taken in a temple on the Capitoline Mount. Now he openly proposed the recall from exile of Sulla's rival Gaius Marius. A consul six times, Marius was an experienced general who twice had defeated invading Germanic tribes and made major reforms to the structure, recruitment, and training of Rome's army. But Marius was a man who divided Romans because of his more recent underhanded tactics, which had led to his exile. Increasingly, supporters of the consuls Cinna and Octavius were coming to blows in the streets, and within months there was a massive riot in the Forum, with the supporters of Octavius gaining the upper hand. In fear for his life, Cinna fled Rome. The Senate, at the behest of the remaining consul Octavius, and against all convention and tradition, rescinded Cinna's consular appointment and removed his Roman citizenship, replacing him as consul with Octavius's ally, Lucius Cornelius Merula. Cinna had headed south to the winter quarters of some legions encamped at Nola, outside Naples, who were there to put down unrest among the local Samnite tribe. With Cinna vowing to recall their revered former general Marius, these troops threw their allegiance behind him. From Nola, Cinna sent for Marius, who was cooling his heels in North Africa. By the summer, Marius had arrived from Africa with a small force. Landing on the coast south of Rome, Marius recruited 6,000 locals to create a legion, then headed north and sacked Ostia, the undefended port of Rome. As Marius next marched the 14 miles up the riverbank to Rome, Cinna took his much larger army north to attack the city from above the Tiber. The consul Octavius reacted by pulling together two armies. One of these forces, located at Rome, was commanded by Gnaeus Pompeius Strabo, a consul 2 years earlier. The other army, encamped in the north of Italy, was commanded by Gnaeus Cecilius Metellus Pius, commonly known as Metellus. Now in his early 40s, Metellus had been a subordinate of Strabo in the past and was still outranked by him. As Cinna neared the capital, he dispatched part of his army under Senators Quintus Sertorius and Papirus Carbo to attack the district of Rome north of the Tiber on and around the Janiculum, today's Janiculo Hill. The Servian Wall ran around the bottom of the Janiculum, and a small fort flanked the hilltop gate. Traditionally, a signal flag atop the fort should have been hauled down at the approach of the Marian force, but the military tribune in charge of the Janiculum garrison was in Cinna's debt. The tribune opened the Janiculum gate to the Marians, allowing them to flood into the city's northern Pan-Tiber suburb. In response, Octavius and Strabo rushed troops across the Tiber bridges and, in bitter fighting, threw out the Marian forces. But the victory came at a terrible cost. 17,000 men under Octavius and Strabo were killed. Octavius then sent messengers hurrying north to instruct Metellus to hasten south with reinforcements, while Strabo and his surviving troops made camp on the Field of Mars. There, a fever quickly spread among Strabo's legionaries, just as it also took hold in the camp of Cinna's battered army several miles away. The Romans called this quartan fever. It was malaria, which was rife in and around Rome in these times and originated from mosquitoes inhabiting the marshes south of Rome. This malarial threat would only be terminated by the filling in of those marshes by the Emperor Claudius in the 1st century. On a humid September afternoon, as an electrical storm raged around him and his men lay in their tents, the arrogant Strabo, who himself had begun to show signs of illness, strode around the camp encouraging his troops to find the strength and the will for a new battle. Strabo was not a popular general, but he was a determined, aggressive, and effective one, and unbendingly loyal to Rome. Despite being a provincial, Strabo had sided with Rome in the social war of 91-88 BC, when Rome's allies throughout Italy had unsuccessfully rebelled against her rule. Strabo was also enormously wealthy. The fact that he was the richest man in the Picenum region in northeastern Italy had earned him entry into the Roman Senate, then a high honour for a provincial. Despite his wealth, Strabo had gained a reputation for greed. In 89 BC, as one of the year's consuls, he had defeated a large Italian army and taken the city of Asculum in his home region of Picenum following a siege of several months. After auctioning off the property of rebel leaders, instead of sharing the proceeds with his soldiers and the treasury at Rome, which was the norm, Strabo had kept the lot. Being a fearsome figure, backed by thousands of troops from his native Picenum, no one in Rome complained. In fact, the Senate that same year awarded him a triumph, with its spectacular victory parade through the streets of Rome. But now, as Strabo defied the weather, and, the more religious believed, defied the gods, striding around his camp in the electrical storm, a bolt of lightning lanced down from the black sky and hit the general, knocking him from his feet. When his aides reached him, the general was dead. Inside Rome, few tears would be shed for Pompeius Strabo. Only barely tolerated by his allies and disliked by his own troops, he was despised by his enemies, among them the family of Gaius Julius Caesar. Young Caesar, who had turned 13 that July, was firmly in the Marian camp. His aunt Julia, sister of his father, another Gaius Julius Caesar, was married to Gaius Marius, which made Marius Caesar's uncle by marriage. In the well-to-do Caesar family home at Rome, there would be no loud or obvious celebrations at the news of Strabo's death. Slaves might pass on news of such seditious joy to Consul Octavius for a reward. But in their own quiet way, Caesar and his family would have enjoyed the news that Octavius's best general had been eliminated, which could only bode well for Caesar's uncle Marius, now only a few miles away, and for Marius's objective of regaining power at Rome. In contrast, in the camp outside the Colline Gate, another young man was grieving. Gnaeus Pompeius was his name, and he was Strabo's son. From the 16th century, British historians and playwrights, including in the 17th century William Shakespeare, would anglicise his name from Pompeius to Pompey, and it is by that name that we have come to know him. Tall, slim Pompey would shortly turn 21. He was not handsome in the classical sense. His eyes were small, his mouth narrow. His thick hair was brushed forward in something of an unkempt mop over a forehead that would soon furrow. Yet his features were neatly in proportion, and in his boyhood friends had compared Pompey to the pretty, all-conquering young Macedonian general Alexander the Great. Pompey hadn't taken the comparison to heart, but neither had he dismissed it, until enemies later made the comparison disparagingly, reminding the world that Alexander had died young and had a scandalous love life. Like Alexander the Great, Pompey's military career had begun in his teens, at the age of 15, when his father Strabo was leading a Roman army against rebelling Italian tribes in the Social War. Later Roman general Valius Paterculus tells us that Pompey joined his father's staff from the very day he officially came of age, during the Liberalis festival in March 90 BC, 6 months before Pompey's 16th birthday on September 29. From the day on which he assumed the toga virilis, he had been trained to military service on the staff of that sagacious general his father, says Valius. This had given Pompey a singular insight into military tactics and developed his excellent natural talent, Velius observed. A Roman youth was presented by his male guardian with the plain white toga virilis on the day of his coming-of-age ceremony, during the liberalis closest to his 16th birthday. This signified his entry into manhood and assumption of the rights of Roman citizenship, which included the right to vote and to own slaves. It's likely that Pompey's toga party, hosted by his father, was held in Strabo's tented headquarters pavilion in a military camp. Probable attendees at the all-male party would have been Pompey's brother-in-law, Gaius Memmius, his father's subordinate general, Marcus Aemilius Lepidus, and other senior officers, as well as his father's freedmen, such as Alexander, his financial manager. It would have been a light-hearted affair, with Pompey's own freedman servant, Demetrius, shaving his master's beard, which he had not been permitted to shave off until his coming of age. The young man's beard hair was then offered in a casket to the family's household gods. There would have been little to shave. Even in his mid-twenties, Pompey would have difficulty growing a full beard when in mourning for a relative. For more than 3 years since his toga party, Pompey had been serving at his father's side, most recently as a military tribune, an officer roughly equivalent to a colonel today. By the time of Strabo's death, Pompey would have commanded a cohort of 600 legionaries for 10 months of the year. The military tribune of this era, typically aged in his early 20s but as young as 18, also took a turn with his legion's 5 fellow tribunes in sharing the rotating command of the legion for 2 months annually. Pompey was his father's heir, inheritor of his Rome mansion and vast estates in Picenum. But Pompey, now an orphan, his mother, of whom we know nothing, was dead by this stage, and still a humble company commander, was without a powerful patron to protect him. The day following Strabo's death, Pompey, as the new front of his family, walked at the head of the funeral procession that would take his father's body to the funeral pyre prepared for him outside the city. Pompey had just one sibling, his elder sister Pompeia, who was probably living in the family home in Rome. Pompeia was then married to Gaius Memmius, who, like Pompey, was still short of senatorial age and held equestrian rank. Like Pompey, too, Memmius would have been serving under Strabo as a military tribune. Because of their family connection, Pompey was close to Memmius and trusted him. As the black-clad funeral cortege made its slow progress, with professional mourners wailing and Pompey and his brother-in-law walking solemnly behind Strabo's bier as it was carried on the shoulders of family retainers, a vast mob of supporters of Marius suddenly descended on the procession. Outnumbering Pompey's party, the Marians grabbed Strabo's body from the bier and carried it away. Pompey, unarmed, struggled vainly to retrieve his father's body. He would never know what happened to it, would never be able to inter his ashes in a noble tomb beside the Appian Way, where all passers-by could see it and remember Strabo, Rome's loyal general. It's likely that Strabo's corpse was cast into the Tiber by the Marian body snatchers to be washed downriver to the marshes or the sea without the benefit of funeral rites or cremation, the fate of other leading senators assassinated by followers of Marius. Pompey would never forget this outrage by the Marians. 2. Caesar's uncle takes power, Pompey on trial. Before the death of Strabo, and before the costly battle of the Janiculum, in which both Strabo and his son Pompey had taken part, Pompey had been in the camp of his father's army as Strabo set himself in Cinna's path north of the Tiber. At the time, Pompey was sharing a 2-man tent with another young military tribune by the name of Lucius Terentius. Over dinner in camp with his 5 fellow tribunes, Pompey had received a whispered warning that Terentius was going to stab him in his bed while he slept, as part of a larger uprising in which other men loyal to Cinna would set fire to his father's tent and raise an uprising in the camp. Young Pompey had not visibly reacted to this warning. Instead, he had drunk more liberally than usual and acted in a very friendly manner toward Terentius. Finishing his meal and bidding his comrades a good night, he went to his tent. There he lumped clothing and bedding in his bed to give the impression he was sleeping in it, then slipped out under the tent flap. Sure enough, Terentius later entered the tent and several times plunged his sword into Pompey's bed, before realizing that Pompey had escaped. Pompey had in fact gone to warn his father, who remained out of sight as the predicted uprising took place. As Cinna's supporters ran riot through the camp, tearing down tents and urging others to march with them to join Cinna, young Pompey tried to reason with them and restore order. Finally, he lay full length in the camp's main gate and, in tears, dramatically implored the troops to either return to his father's authority or trample him to death. In the end, such was the esteem in which young Pompey was held, only 800 men, Terentius among them, deserted to Cinna's side. Some 30,000 others heeded Pompey's call and remained loyal to his father, who subsequently withdrew the army to Rome in time for the Battle of the Janiculum. We never hear of the budding assassin Terentius again. In the wake of the death of Pompey's father, his rank-and-file soldiery was restless and reluctant to continue fighting for Octavius against the forces of Cinna and the famous Marius, which outnumbered them 2-1. Octavius was desperately awaiting the arrival of Metellus with reinforcements from the north. When he learned that Metellus had reached the hill town of Alba Longa, just 12 miles southeast of Rome, Octavius arranged a meeting there. When Octavius arrived, he found Metellus's troops agitating for Metellus to take command from him. With Metellus and his army remaining at Alba, Octavius scurried back to Rome and reported to the Senate, which humiliated him by calling on him to negotiate with Cinna now that he had lost one of his generals and lost the support of the other. When Octavius met with Cinna's delegates, they assured him that Cinna only wanted his citizenship and consulship restored. If Octavius agreed, all would be forgiven. "I will not willingly cause anyone's death on re-entering Rome," was Cinna's message to Octavius. Based on this, Octavius agreed to a cessation of hostilities, after which Strabo's former troops quickly swore loyalty to Cinna. The day before Cinna re-entered Rome, Merula resigned from the consulship, paving the way for the Senate to restore Cinna's citizenship and consulship. Once he was back in his city house, Cinna's bodyguards proceeded to break into the Roman homes of dead and absent supporters of Octavius, including Strabo and Metellus, looting them. Cinna did, however, keep his word to refrain from violence and restrained his men from doing any physical harm to his opponents. When Marius refused to enter the city until his exile of the previous year was overturned, the Senate swiftly complied. Greeted by crowds of overjoyed supporters, Marius now re-entered Rome as a returning hero, and the Caesar family, among others, breathed a sigh of relief. But unlike his colleague Cinna, Marius had given no undertaking to refrain from acts of revenge. As Marius crossed the Pomerium, hundreds of former slaves of his personal bodyguard unit, the Bardii, flooded ahead of him, all lusting for blood. The Bardii, led by Marius's officers, including Gaius Censorinus, went on a killing rampage, murdering leading Sulla supporters, starting with Consul Octavius and former Consul Merula. Censorinus personally decapitated Octavius and sent his head to Marius. Octavius's general Metellus only escaped the bloodletting because he was at Alba. He fled Italy to Africa, where he had numerous wealthy clients. Other key Sullans were charged by Marius and Cinna with major crimes, all punishable with exile. Rather than face show trials and inevitable exile, losing all their property, 14 senators, including 6 former consuls, took their own lives. The young Pompey survived the worst aspects of this purge because he was quartered among his father's former troops. But as his father's heir, he was charged by Marius with receiving the stolen property of the Roman treasury. This was the loot from Asculum, which Marius reckoned Strabo should have given to the treasury. Calmly and deliberately, Pompey, now 21 years old, prepared his defence. A At several hearings he appeared before Antistius, one of the year's 8 elected praetors, or senior judges. Each praetor dealt with a different category of crime, with Antistius specialising in embezzlement. Skilfully, Pompey proved that while he had been with his father during the siege of Asculum, the proceeds from the auction following the siege had been stolen by Alexander, his father's Greek freedman. In the process, Pompey impressed all with an ability, dignity, and self-confidence that were considered well beyond his years. One charge after another was dismissed, until just one remained, that Pompey had received Asculum booty, hunting tackle, and books from his father. In answer, Pompey asked how he could be charged with possession of such goods when they had been stolen from his father's house, now his house, a spacious residence with extensive gardens in the Carini, or Keels, Rome's most fashionable residential district on the Esquiline Hill. And who had stolen these goods from his father's house? None other than sinners' guards. As Pompey was able to prove, these guards had entered the city with Cinna and had gone directly to Strabo's house, broken in and stolen every portable valuable on the dead general's property. It should be they, said Pompey, who were charged with possession of stolen goods. This very likely brought sympathetic laughter from the crowded public gallery, for the case had raised the ire of supporters of the popular youth. The judge Antistius was certainly impressed. During the trial he invited Pompey to dinner. There he proposed that Pompey marry his daughter Antistia. Without hesitation Pompey agreed, and a written marriage contract was drawn up and signed in secret by Antistius and Pompey. But the secret soon leaked, and after Antistius reconvened the court and announced that the judges were unanimously acquitting the young man of the final charge, good-natured cheers of Talasio filled the courtroom. It was, you see, the custom at weddings for the guests to cry Talasio to bid the happy couple good fortune. So Pompey was off the hook. Just a few days later, he and Antistia were discreetly married, and, as custom required, he carried her over the threshold of his home, his late father's vandalized house in the Keels, to the cheers and applause of wedding guests. We are told nothing of Pompey's bride. She would have been a teenager, Roman girls being permitted by Roman law to become engaged at 12 years of age and to marry from 13. Typically, when girls so young were married off, often to create a family alliance, their husbands refrained from having sexual relations with them until they were older. This seems to have been the case with Pompey and Antistia, for this marriage, which would last close to 5 years, would produce no children. Not that Pompey lacked sexual experience. He had a mistress in his teens. All young Roman men of aristocratic birth were encouraged by their fathers to gain sexual experience with courtesans so they would know how to pleasure their wives once they married. This, they believed, was far better than for their sons to roam the streets in drunken bands of upper-class youths that frequented the common brothels, as Mark Antony would do in the coming decades. Conversely, the brides of aristocrats were expected to be virgins, unless they had previously been married. Courtesans, instead of inhabiting common brothels with their partitioned cubicles occupied by whores who were usually slaves, were wealthy women with their own houses and their own slaves, their wealth being provided by rich clients. The woman who taught Pompey all about making love was Dora, a famous beauty who enchanted all who came in contact with her. 2 decades before she took Pompey to her bed, another of her noble initiates had been none other than Metellus, the general whose failure to support Octavius had led to Octavius's downfall and death. Metellus had been so enamoured with Dora that he raised a statue of her in Rome's temple of Castor and Pollux. Dora was in middle age by the time she took Pompey in hand, but was still a stunning beauty. It would turn out that she fell in love with him, won by his youthful good looks, gentle manner, and kindness. In old age, she would recall that whenever he left her bed, she would give him the parting gift of a bite. And then one day, Pompey's companion, Geminius, confessed that he had fallen for Dora. When Geminius asked Pompey if he could bed her, Pompey gave his permission, but he himself never again went near Dora. she was devastated and fell into a deep depression. Pompey had a code of ethics when it came to women and propriety. His freedman Demetrius had a beautiful wife, and she seemed charmed by Pompey. So, while he retained Demetrius's services until the day he died...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?